Hi, this is Patti LuPone.
This is Allison Janney.
This is Matt Ballmer.
This is Donna Murphy.
This is Nia Vardalos.
This is Jesse Tyler Ferguson.
This is Beanie Feldstein.
I'm Octavia Spencer.
This is Ben Platt, and you're listening to Little Known Facts with my favorite person on the planet, Alana Levine.
A-OK.
Welcome to Little Known Facts, a podcast where you will hear unfiltered, raw, honest, and uniquely funny interviews with artists you love as they talk about the art they love to make. I'm your host, Ilana Levine.
Hey, I heard you needed inspiration. Here's Ilana and friends with some revelations. Little known fact of the day. Every little thing's gonna be A-OK.
Hey everyone, new episodes of Little Known Facts drop every Monday and you can find them on your favorite podcast provider. Also, if you go to the website, littleknownfactspodcast.com, you'll find behind the scenes photos, videos, and interviews and lots more on the gallery page. And if you are loving these intimate, candid conversations with all the artists who come on the show, please head over to the contributions page. I depend on these donations to continue to bring you these interviews every week. So if you love the show, please donate. Little known fact about my guest today. In 1996, his father became the royal family vicar, and my guest has had the opportunity to sing for the Queen. Welcome Julian Ovenden to the podcast.
A-OK. A-OK.
Hey everyone, my guest today is the Screen Actors Guild award-winning actor Julian Ovenden. Julian lives in England but has had an incredible career working on both sides of the pond with roles on Broadway, the West End, television, and film. He has starred on Downton Abbey as Charles Blake. He plays Bobby Kennedy on the British series The Crown and played his brother John F. Kennedy on the American series Smash. He is a recording artist with three solo albums and sings in concerts all over the world. His latest role, playing William de Nogaret, a Machiavellian lawyer for King Philip of France on the television series Nightfall for the History Channel, just started this week, and I got to see it last night, and he was amazing. Welcome, Julian, to the podcast.
Thanks very much for having me.
So many of us know about American early history from the musical Hamilton, and I learned so much about this time, you know, in 1290, about the knights. And so I was going to ask you if this was something you were familiar with, or did you learn it by researching the part?
I have to say, I had a sort of basic rudimentary kind of understanding of who the knights were. You know, they were these quite a very powerful but mysterious religious army, I suppose. And they were set up to kind of protect Christians who made pilgrimages to the Holy Land, and to protect Christianity and to protect, you know, the religious artifacts. And our story sort of takes place really when they're sort of the decline and fall of the Knights Templar, when they've been kicked out of the Holy Land and they're existing in little sort of sets all over Europe. And our show is based in Paris, and they built the, you know, medieval Paris in on the back lot of the sets, the film studio in Prague, which was an amazing, incredible, huge undertaking. It's really impressive sets. And yeah, so it's really a show about them kind of trying to reestablish themselves in a new area, and also the power struggles, the sort of religious wrangling, I think, that goes on at this particular time in history. So there's quite a lot of textures in the show, and quite a lot happening.
How do you say your character's name? I don't want to butcher it again.
William de Nogaret is how I say it. I think that's probably how the French would pronounce it. I mean, we're not using French accents. Read a review actually yesterday or 2 days ago saying, why aren't they all speaking in French accents? Well, I think it would be slightly ridiculous.
If that's the case, we might just use French actors, might we not? So was William de Nogaret, was he a real person?
He was a real person. You know, I think one of the great things about this show is we try and stick as much as possible to the real history. Obviously, there are some licenses. You want to make it entertaining. You want to keep the viewers excited by the show. And sometimes you have to take some license with some of the dates and some of the, you know, sort of characteristics of people. But my character is very much involved in the politics of the time. He was a modernizer. He was an atheist. He's the only, I suppose, the only non-believer in the show. You know, the show is chock full of, I suppose, religious fundamentalists. He sees through all that. And his parents were killed by a previous pope. And he's a sort of self-made man, very brilliant, clever lawyer, an advisor to the King Philip of France. And so there's quite a lot written about him, which is good, actually, because it gave me a lot of research material.
Did you have to audition for this part?
I did.
What was that like?
It was okay, I think.
You got it.
Anyway, I got it, yeah, which is a rare occurrence.
That is so not true. Having lived with you on YouTube for the last week, watching everything, you know, I could get my hands on, were there multiple reads for it or did you go in once?
I think they were wondering which part I was right for. So I think I went in a couple of times. But it's quite rare, actually. I mean, I don't know what conversations you have with actors nowadays about the audition process, but it's changed somewhat. It's actually quite rare to meet another human being whilst going through the process. It used to be, I remember the first time I went to Los Angeles about 12 years ago, and for a pilot, I remember doing about 7 or 8, you know, physical meetings to actually get the job. Nowadays, it's all done on iPhones. I can be sitting here recording a scene for, I don't know, whatever it may be, the Pokemon movie, which I'll be doing on Monday.
The audition or the film?
The audition, unfortunately. And it can be sent off within 2 minutes, and someone in some sky rise in Culver City or in Burbank.
No, Julian, it's me. I wanted to tell all the actors out there, all those self-tapes that they're doing that they think no one is watching, they are actually sent to me. And I want you to know, I'm watching.
Good.
Did you in fact self-tape for Nightfall, or did you actually get to meet people?
I met another human being.
That might be why you got it.
Maybe.
Well, speaking of accents, what is remarkable to me is both in a lot of the singing that you've done, you know, when you sing Rodgers and Hammerstein or other big American musicals, you have a perfect American accent. You do a perfect American accent on Person of Interest and obviously in Smash and other shows you've done here. You mentioned that 12 years ago you came to LA for the first time. Was that the beginning of your auditioning for American roles?
In earnest, I think, yes. I mean, I had done a few little bits and bobs, I think, before that, but I'd done quite a lot of period drama before then, and I wanted to sort of broaden my skill set, I suppose, and broaden my experiences. It wasn't like I wanted to become famous. I think a lot of people, you know, come to LA for pilot season because they're, you know, sort of, they want to be big in movies or big in TV. It was more, I mean, it sounds sort of slightly pious and altruistic, but I wanted to be stretched as an actor, and I didn't want to play the same kind of types of parts. And with an American accent, or with any accent other than English, because we, you know, of our class system, you can really be anything. And I feel like I open myself up to lots more opportunities. And I used to have a sort of phobia about accents. I didn't think I was very good, but I've sort of learned how to do it now, and I really enjoy the process of taking on a new language, which is basically what it is.
So I sort of buried the lead by starting off that comment with your being able to sing magnificently in these American musicals. Where did this love of performing begin? Did you grow up listening to cast albums? Where did all of this passion happen?
I mean, I did have a musical upbringing. I was a chorister when I was a kid at St. Paul's Cathedral in London. So I had a fairly heavy duty sort of musical upbringing from the age of 7, which meant that I was doing, you know, 3 or 4 hours of music a day.
How did you know that you could sing at such an early age? Was that something that you discovered? Did people go like, wow, Julian has an amazing voice? Where was it, through church?
Maybe. I mean, my dad's a vicar, and it was a way of, they didn't have an awful lot of money, my parents, and it was a way of, you know, it was a way of affording a good education, frankly. And it certainly paved my way through, you know, some, you know, great schools and, you know, great university. But in terms of sort of musical work, musical, you know, cap with a capital M, I had no real appreciation really for anything. I mean, the first time I properly listened to, I guess, a musical was when I auditioned for Merrily We Roll Along.
That was your introduction to Sondheim.
It was, yeah. And I didn't know, I just didn't know it. It wasn't part of my musical diet. So it's been really rather nice to sort of, you know, discover things as I've gone along. But now I would class as some of my favorite music, particularly the music of Rodgers and Hammerstein and Jerome Kern and Irving Berlin and Gershwin, et cetera, et cetera.
So you kind of immersed yourself in that later on in life.
I did, I suppose, yeah.
So was Merrily We Roll Along, was that your first West End musical?
Yeah, it was at a wonderful theater called the Donmar Warehouse.
Yeah, yeah. My husband's worked there.
Yeah, it's a small little boutique theater.
Was that when Sam Mendes was running it?
This was when Sam was running it, exactly. It was, I think, his two or three jobs before he left. It's a wonderful, wonderful space, very intimate. And it had the reputation, still has a reputation, for sort of deconstructing, I suppose, established works or doing pieces of work like Merrily that hadn't quite succeeded in the past.
Yeah.
And it was my second job, actually, and it really kind of gave me a great, you know, it was a great help to me. It's really started my career off. And it was an amazing experience on many levels. One, to be working with, you know, Steve Sondheim and, you know, playing a part that is sort of semi
autobiographical.
Oh, yes.
So he was there?
He was there, yeah. Oh, he was there for quite a lot of it.
Oh, that's not intimidating at all.
Well, I knew he was a kind of big, you know, he was a big deal. And if I was doing something now with him, I'd probably be a little bit more, I don't know, a little bit more starstruck. I just didn't sort of, it didn't register with me on that kind of level. And he was delightful and rewrote stuff. And, you know, there were moments where we'd both be sitting at the piano because I had to play quite a lot in the show. And it's a kind of amazing experience. Yeah. And the show was a massive hit. Should have transferred, but because of politics, it never did. Because George Firth decided that he didn't approve the version that we did, or I don't know, because there's quite a few versions.
Sure.
It was going to go to Broadway, but never made it, unfortunately.
So that was the beginning of a career that has really been able to go back and forth between musical experiences and non-musical experiences, which is a really extraordinary thing. There aren't that many actors who can kind of bounce around in that way. Do your agents ever get confused about how to direct you or what you want to do? Or do you just throw everything out there and see what makes sense?
You know, I'd love to have a bit more choice. I mean, I think most of us being actors would have a bit more choice. I've done my best to try and, you know, have a career that pays, you know, for a living, but also having a career that is exciting and is constantly, you know, challenging. And I get bored quite easily. And I try very hard to kind of mix it up. I don't do musical after musical. And it's harder in England, although, you know, I've spent a lot of time in America where you can go from a musical to a film, to a television show, to a play. People are much more, I suppose, open to that. In England, we're a bit more snobbish about it.
Do you mean that people get sort of pigeonholed, you do this or you do this, or they're less willing for you to do both?
Yes. And there are many people who just do musicals. And, you know, so I suppose I am in the minority. There's not many people, I guess, who do what I do. And I'm proud of that. And I feel it makes me a better actor, because I think some of the stuff you have to do in musicals is really, really hard. You know, in a wonderful Chekhov play, you have, you know, have 80 pages to really be very detailed and very, you know, very thorough about a character. On musicals, sometimes you just have three lines.
Right, and then you burst into song.
You know, and then you have song, which obviously helps. It's a different kind of discipline. You know, I enjoy it all, really.
So you said that you grew up a chorister, and I'm from Teaneck, New Jersey, and that was not a word that I grew up with. Does that mean just someone who's in a chorus?
Choir. It means choir. A boy singer.
Okay, so I'm going to use that word all the time now. So as a chorister, when did you switch gears? And obviously you do performances all over the world, but you are an opera-trained singer with this incredible tenor voice. When did you switch gears?
I sang at a choir in my Oxford. I went to Oxford University. I studied music there, and I sang in a choir there. And I guess I got to a stage sort of halfway through my time at university where I felt like I needed to decide what I was going to do. And one avenue, I suppose, would have been to continue to sing and to do another 2 or 3 years postgraduate training at a, you know, music college.
Sure.
But I kind of was impatient. I wanted to get going. I had a sort of motor inside of me that wanted to perform. I wanted to create. And I didn't want to be in any more institutions. And I decided that I should, you know, I did an acting course after I left university, a 1 year postgraduate course. And I realized, you know, after about 4 or 5 days that that's what I wanted to do. I was with the people that really excited me. And I just knew that, you know, that was the path. And it wasn't like I was turning my back on music, because I felt that I could always use it. But I just felt, you know, the world was right for me.
Did you have a family that was supportive of this idea? You know, most parents are quite trepidatious about their children pursuing a career in the arts. What was your family's response to that?
Pretty good, to be honest with you.
That's nice.
I mean, now I'm a parent myself, I can sort of understand it better. Mm. And if my son said, oh, you know, I want to be a dancer or an actor, or I'm going to support him, whatever he wants to do, whatever makes him happy. But I guess there would be a part of me, having had the experience myself, knowing that it is a hard, tough road. But I think if you're going to do it, you just got to go and do it.
Was it tough for you, or did you sort of break through pretty quickly?
I think it's still tough.
Yeah.
I mean, there are wonderful things about it. I'm very, very grateful for the work that I've had and the career that I've had. You know, I'd be lying to, you know, if I told you that it was plain sailing the whole time. I mean, there's a lot of insecurity. Just trying to manage day-to-day life sometimes can be really tricky. And, you know, a lot of things don't go your way. There's a lot of rejection for, you know, for random reasons. But it's a wonderful thing. You meet wonderful people and get to travel. And, you know, sometimes I don't have to get up in the morning, which is a joy. And, you know, and work with brilliant, you know, the geniuses of our day.
Have you had to do other jobs along the way that weren't acting to keep this going?
No, luckily I haven't. No. And I'm in the minority there.
Mm.
I might do in the future. Who knows?
Well, not if Pokemon comes your way, which I'm feeling as we speak, I'm feeling better and better about that. Aren't you?
Yeah, I am. I'm feeling it. I really am feeling it.
So there really wasn't a time where you felt like, I'm going to walk away from this.
I think, no, there have been times when I'm like, I'm fed up with being told no.
Mm.
Fed up with not being in control.
Yeah.
You know, I'm fed up with playing this role when I should be playing that role. All the things that I think most people, you know, I think everyone, whether you're Meryl Streep to whoever it may be, there are many frustrations. There are different kinds of frustrations. You know, there's just a basic need to eat and, you know, clothe yourself.
Sure.
There's that demand. But then, you know, artistically, you want to be doing the best work you can. And sometimes that's not possible. And you have to take a job just for the money or for the exposure rather than the, you know, the sheer love of it. So it's always a balancing act. But I'm grateful that I'm still here after almost 20 years, you know, still bashing away. You know, my career has been, you know, I've never had a job that is just sort of propelled me into stardom. It's been sort of fairly constant, you know, chipping away.
Obviously, here in America, we don't have a royal family, but recently we've become obsessed all over again because one of our own is meant to marry Prince Harry, an actress no less. And so it's been very exciting here on this side of the pond. I happen to know, when you mentioned earlier that your dad was a vicar, not only was he a vicar, but he then became a vicar for the royal families. Do I have my facts correct?
You do. That's right. Yeah. For 15 years, he lived in Windsor, just next door to the Queen Mother.
Break that down for me. Again, the girl from Teaneck. What did that mean for your family? What did that mean for you?
I'd left home. My brother was still there at home. My sister had left. But it was a kind of an extraordinary job, an extraordinary insight into another world. And so his job was to look after, you know, kind of religious affairs of the Queen and the royal family when they were in Windsor at the castle. And the Queen has a private chapel in the what's called the Great Park, which is the, you know, the big stretch of land that, you know, is adjacent to the castle.
Yeah.
Yeah, so he got to, you know, get to know them really, really well. He saw them, you know, every week at least once. Yeah, I mean, it's an extraordinary, extraordinary experience, especially, you know, as the royal family has evolved. So much has changed over the last, well, since Diana, I suppose. So that's 20 years, isn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, he was there throughout all the kind of, I suppose, the a kind of royal revolution.
And so did you get to know any of the members of the family?
I wouldn't say no. I mean, I've met most of them. I've sung for most of them. I sang at the Queen's 90th birthday party, which was a great honour and great fun. I've sung for Prince Charles a number of times. So I sort of still have connections there, I suppose. But I wouldn't say I was like great mates with any of them.
Yet. Well, I guess Meghan Markle will not be acting anymore, right? Like, she's sort of saying that she's not going to do that.
I wouldn't know how these things work, but I would have thought that she'd want to continue with her work. Whether that, you know, runs contrary to royal duties, I'm not too sure. But I think given the modern way that those boys sort of lead their lives, I don't know. She's a smart girl, isn't she? I'm sure she'll be doing something interesting and, you know, worthwhile.
Yeah.
I don't know enough about her, to be honest with you.
Right. I'd be hard-pressed to not talk about Downton with you, because that was a really magical show that really took off internationally, which you got to be a part of. And I know it had already sort of left the station when you joined it. And I just wonder if you could talk a little bit about your experience. I thought you were amazing on it. And I love all the different hairstyles you have on all the different jobs that you do, by the way. Or do you like your hair?
Do I like my hair?
Yeah. Does it work for you?
I don't dislike it. I mean, it's not like I get up in the morning and go, God, I've got gray hair.
You don't. Oh, all right. I think you had a middle part in Downton.
I don't know. I like changing up. I like changing my appearance. I guess that's sort of an actory kind of thing.
Yeah.
But I do like in Nightfall, for example, I don't think many people would recognize me. I can't imagine anyone's going to recognize me on the street from Nightfall, because it is a completely different, look.
If you wear the tunic and that cap, perhaps, but without that, I would imagine you are correct. You would be anonymous.
Yeah, exactly. Which I quite like, really. I quite like disappearing into other people. But Downton was, I don't know. I mean, I feel like I had not very much to do over a period of about 2 years. I remember sort of saying one line every 2 or 3 weeks. It was a joy to be involved in it. Lovely people, great to be in a show that people watch, especially in America, had such a following. The sort of hysteria, really, that surrounded it. It's lovely. It was a great experience in that respect.
And they brought you the entire cast over for the SAG Awards, which I thought was amazing, and that you were part of the ensemble at that point has made you a Screen Actors Guild award-winning actor for life.
I guess so, yeah. I mean, that's nice, isn't it? I mean, I have an award somewhere in the house, which is lovely.
Mm.
I don't know whether I deserve it. I mean, I don't know how much of that award is actually really down to me, but I'll take it.
No one's asked for it back.
No one, not yet, anyway. It's great. It's great. I tried to sort of make the character as much of a kind of a foil to Michelle as possible. And I felt like that, when I was asked whether I'd be interested in doing it, I said, I remember having a discussion with Julian Fellows about, you know, my feelings were that the show needed a stronger sort of male kind of someone to stand up to her. So it was quite fun to sort of try and to kind of create someone, with that in mind. And I felt it frustrating, because there are so many characters and so many storylines that are kind of squeezed into an hour of television. You don't get an awful lot of chance. Sometimes I felt frustrated that I didn't get enough, meat on the bone. But at the end of the day, I'm just an actor, and I was very happy to be in the number one show on television.
Did you know Tom Cullen before?
I did not. No, I did not. So we met on that. And it's been lovely to be, you know, to be back with him
on Nightfall.
Yeah, and he's really grown, I think, as an actor,
and his muscles as well.
He has.
He did quite the workout for Nightfall. You did not have to do boot camp with those guys, right?
My workout was in the
craft service.
Public houses of Prague, which are, you know, heavy duty carbohydrates,
yes,
lots of dumplings and all that stuff. He led the cast extremely well, Tom, in the show, and it was lovely to see him. You know, I can't really sort of flower. I think he's much younger than me and much more successful. And I think he's going to do great, you know, great, interesting work in the future. So
why? How old is he?
Oh, he's probably at least 10 years younger than me.
Really?
Yeah. I know he doesn't seem, it's my skin regime that keeps me looking.
Yes, I thought, exactly. You look like twins to me. Well, I do feel like because of Tom Cullen and because of your performance and a lot of the Nightfall ensemble of actors, there's lots of blood and gore and sort of the Game of Thrones genre that make people really happy right now. But I felt like by having you at the center, all of you incredible actors, what really comes through is the drama and the human need that each of these people are experiencing. And when you said that William Dinugaret's childhood had been sort of brutal, I feel like that gives great insight into why he at times can be not the nicest guy in the world, and to kind of have a humanizing aspect of it for yourself in terms of it's really not fun to play a villain who's just a villain.
I mean, I never think of him as a villain. I mean, I think you're right. I think, you know, there's a few kind of aims for the show. One of the big aims was to, you know, it was a military show, mm-hmm. you know, so there's action. And personally, I find, you know, kind of action rather dull unless the story is interesting. I'm sort of bored of CGI. I'm bored of superheroes. I'm
right.
bored of just endless people getting killed.
I know.
It's not interesting.
And when you have little kids, it's also, you have a whole other perspective on that.
Take a film like Dunkirk, for example, which, you know, there's obviously a lot of, there's you know, it was a very, very brutal experience. But the way the film, you know, worked for me was you saw the human side of it. You saw the wonderful way that he's able to embroider all these sort of characters around this very, very bloody, you know, day of history. And I think that Nightfall, over the course of 10 episodes, even though there is quite a lot of claret, you know, spurting around,
yeah,
there's a lot of human, really good, you know, well-worked, you know, investigated human drama that I think sort of deepens as you get to know the characters and as the show, you know, continues. And I think that it gets better and better as it goes along.
Oh, that's really exciting. So one thing I ask all of my guests is if they can think of what is now maybe in retrospect humorous, but at the time was one of the hardest audition scenarios they'd ever been in. Maybe it even borders on humiliating, but it's funny now. Does something come to mind of an audition story that would make people out there feel less alone by hearing Julian's version of a really haywire experience in an audition room?
Oh God, I've got about 30. I mean, I've got hundreds. The first audition I did in America,
yeah,
it was for Bryan Singer. It was for the pilot of House. Do you remember House?
Yes,
with Hugh
of course.
And I did, I was terrified. We were in Sony or I can't remember, one of those big studios, or Fox, something like that. And he, and I started the thing and he fell asleep.
No, he did not.
He actually fell asleep.
So what happens when?
The cast director had to wake him up.
Okay.
There was another one where I was doing, it was some comedy audition which was really going really badly, and I was sitting on a sofa in an office somewhere, and I leant, and it was terrible, it was really awful, and I was really struggling to try and make anyone laugh, and I leant back onto the wall, and somehow I don't know, my head hit the wall quite hard and it dislodged a large clock that was hanging above me, and the clock fell right onto my lap.
Uh-huh.
So there I was holding this clock, not really knowing what. Oh, it was just a disaster.
And that job, my friends.
Yeah, yeah.
That was for Pokemon.
I mean, I could bore you for hours on things that have happened, but But those two that sort of stick in my mind for now anyway.
And don't you just find it remarkable that you got up the next day and decided to do it again? Like there's something.
No, I know, that's true. But you do. I mean, you know, it is a strange profession because there's no rhyme or reason to it. You know, if I was a classical pianist and I practiced and I was pretty damn good, then you could rationalize what jobs I was, you know, right for, what jobs I could get. There's a scale, you know, but for acting, there are thousands of actors out there who are making a lot of money who are rubbish.
Yeah. Do you want to name some of them?
No, I would never even name. No, but you know what I mean? And there are a lot of actors, wonderful, wonderful, wonderful actors who can't get a look in. And that's just the nature. Some people just, there's luck. It's a lot of luck involved, or there's a look involved, or there's a zeitgeist involved that, you know, you're in the right place at the right time and suddenly you're very, very successful. And it's something you can, you know, give up for a while and then come back to. I mean, I always think that it's a craft, and to get really, really good and to be able to kind of do different things and play different characters, then it takes application. It takes years and years and years. And you look at something like, you know, one of my heroes, Mark Rylance, who, you know, kind of just going on and on and on and on and on, a lot of theatre, and now suddenly he's, you know, reaping the fruits of...
of being a movie star.
Yeah, which is great. Good for him, because he's so wonderful. Amazing actor.
Well, I just have to say, as someone who really has spent an extraordinary amount of time researching your work and watching your work and having known it before I even knew I was going to have the privilege of interviewing you, I mean, you've kind of been on all of my guilty pleasures. So I thank you. I thank you for that. But I just want to say that you are one of the most gifted, talented artists working right now. I really encourage anyone who hasn't heard Julian sing to do so, whether you get one of his albums or just listen to the...
Should be my agent. Are you agents to people? Yes. Are you managing?
Yes. It's called Offer Only. That's it. I can't deal with anything. You either want my guy or you don't want my guy. He's not auditioning. He has done everything possible from Sondheim to Nightfall. Seriously. What else do we... Look at his hair. Look at all his hairstyles. You're worried about him looking the part. But seriously, I just think you are an extraordinary talent. And the fact that we in the U.S. get to enjoy you in person when you come do theater here. Your concerts are extraordinary. Your ability to sing, you know, a song from Carousel makes me weep. And I'm just so happy that I got this time with you. And you really bring such integrity and incredible nuance and depth to every role you play in every genre. It's really extraordinary. So I consider myself lucky to have had this time with you today. And I hope, you know, we have a mutual friend in Kelly O'Hara, and I know that there's some potential singing the two of you are going to do together shortly.
Well, there was a chance of doing a musical maybe together at one stage. Yeah. It didn't work out in the end. But I think we're going to do a concert in February.
At Lincoln Center, right?
Yes, I think so, yeah. And then maybe one day... do a proper show.
I'd like to see the two of you at Royal Albert Hall, if that's all right.
Yeah, that would be nice.
Well, Julian, it's such a pleasure talking to you. Thank you for coming on the podcast. It's just been extraordinary. And until next time.
Clouds can make the wind blow. Bugs can make the grass grow. So there you go. These are little known facts that count. You know.
If you want more information about my guests, go to the website littleknownfactspodcast.com. I also wanted to tell you that there is now a new addition to the website. It is a button that says contributions. This podcast is a true labor of love, and I really, really want to keep doing it for a long time. So if you like listening as much as I love to do it, please feel free to contribute. It would mean the world to me. Also, on Twitter, you can find me at Alana Levine. Instagram is Little Known Facts Podcast, and on Facebook, Little Known Facts Podcast. You can also feel free to rate and review the show on the iTunes show page. This podcast is recorded at Hangar Studios in New York City. This episode was brought to you by Pro Media. Located in Times Square, Pro Media offers both production and post-production services out of its beautiful studios in the heart of New York City. Pro Media, sound vision. Find out more at promedia.nyc.
This is the story of the one. As head of maintenance at a concert hall, he knows the show must always go on. That's why he works behind the scenes, ensuring every light is working, the HVAC is humming, and his facility shines. With Grainger's supplies and solutions for every challenge he faces, plus 24/7 customer support, his venue never misses a beat. Call quickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.